For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
I'm sort of calling, I'm thinking of this talk as sort of a call and response, and hopefully what I mean by that will become kind of clear as I speak. We don't often talk about it, I don't recall ever having done so, but indeed we, in our meetings here, begins with a kind of a call. The reader, whoever, tonight it was Daniel, whoever it is, 15 minutes before, strikes the Han. And at 15 minutes before, and then once midway, and then just a minute before we start, it's a call to Zazen. And the part that people may not think about much is that in doing that, we are also, in a way, starting our formal practice here with a poem. We have a shortened version of it here. I think the Han reads, life and death is the great matter. Don't waste time. And so every time that the reader is striking that, that message is going out. Life and death is a great matter. Maybe you want to sit down. As I said, that's kind of a shortened version of a traditional gatha or a poem. Has many different versions. Usually four lines. The one that they used to use at Tassajara, it's now been altered slightly, I understand, but it went, listen, everyone, birth and death is given once. This moment now is gone. Awake, each one, awake. Don't waste this life. And the way that would work is when you get up in the morning, you get up early in the morning, the head monk, who I don't know when she got up, in my case, she, because she had other things to do, but at 3:50 she'd, you know, walk around all over the place and ring the bell, waking people up, telling them that they have, like, I think it was a half an hour to get to the meditation hall. And as a newcomer there, I sometimes, with other newcomers, had the role of what we call jikido. And the Jikido also got up a little earlier, and, you know, they go through, it's kind of spread out, so they kind of run around and light all the gas lanterns, and so people can find their way. And then they go down and stand maybe, I don't know, 150, 200 yards away, kind of down at the other end. Then the Shusho finds her way to the Han, similar to this, and starts hitting it. And then the Jikido, whoever's Jikido that day, you know, listens. And sometimes it was quite challenging because in the winter, when I was there anyway, it was like a lot of times, you know, it's dark and it's rainy and the wind's blowing and you're quite a ways away. And so you're like really straining to, you know, to catch it sometimes. But, you know, she would hit and then you'd hit. And then she'd hit, and then you'd hit. And then as it speeds up, you know, you get this thing going. And that's the call. So it's sort of a, you know, call from the Zendo and sort of a response on behalf of the community, or at least that's how I think of it. Gives everybody a chance to hear, gives them an opportunity to drag themselves out of bed and go up there. That's when I started thinking about it. It's, you know, back when I sort of thought of it, this is call and not only a call, but it's a call and response. So that's one version of the gatha. My favorite version of the gatha is one we used to use when I practiced somewhere else, and slightly different. It wasn't on a Han. The way it would work is somebody to wake you up in the morning, and you know, you do whatever you need to do, and you get your way to the meditation hall, you know, and it was always dark, it's a few candles, you know, very atmospheric, and then you would start to do prostrations, and you'd do 108 prostrations. You know, that's a number of some significance, but you know, so you do 25 in silence. You know, you're going down to the ground. 25 of them, and then the person who's the timekeeper for this part, you know, you get to 25 and you pause, and that person would very sort of boldly go, "Great is the problem of birth and death." And it's very sort of riveting, you know. It's like, you know, it's quiet, it's dark, and you go, whoa, you know. And then you do another 25, and I won't do the whole thing. But again, you know, that sort of really loud voice, it would be, impermanence surrounds us. You do another 25, and they would say, be awake at every moment. And then you do another 25, and they would announce, you know, do not waste this life. And then you'd do a final 8, and you would sit down. And part of the reason I like that last version is because just sort of the drama of it, the, you know, it always made my, well, if I had hair, it would have made it stand on end. And and it really brings it home, yeah. Birth and death, birth and death. And I think that's been on a lot of people's minds in different ways. You know, obviously we did a memorial for these people who were killed. In that way, you know, it's not only us who are sitting here tonight, because there are people everywhere, really, who are sharing in that sort of dismay and concern. But it's not only in Sandy Hook, of course, and it's, you know, it's, we have many school children, many more school children killed every year in Chicago by gunfire. But it's not only in Chicago, and it's not only in, boy, name the place, Sudan, Syria, you know, any place. And that's the point. It's every place. It's every place. And it's not only in the sort of very dramatic kinds of things that kind of catch our attention, but in a million small ways. It's, you know, we all have our own mortality, so-called, whatever. You know, and for many of us, that's an abstract kind of thing that we'll think about sometime, because it's often in the future. And then for others of us, you know, even here tonight, it's a matter of like immediate preoccupation and concern. But in any case, for all of us, birth and death is an issue. And later on, I'm going to read a bit from a fascicle by Dogen, the founder of this tradition, called Shoji, Birth and Death. But the characters for Shoji, you know, I won't try to write them in the air or whatever, can be read, they mean life and death, or birth and death. Either one of those is equally good. There's another reading of the same characters, which is Seishi. And Seishi is a Japanese transliteration of the word samsara, you know. So when we think about a problem of birth and death, it's not so difficult to think about, you know, the problem you know, by way of there, go to the problem of samsara and think, oh, yes, 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 yes. You know, this is actually a more general thing. The problem really is the problem of dukkha, or suffering, because that's the issue of, and sort of the defining characteristic, actually, of samsara. That word literally in the Sanskrit means something like, you know, continuous flow. You know, it's this idea of just sort of going around and around and around, and you know, being caught up by our own sort of patterns in such a way that we continually reproduce our own suffering and our own dukkha. That's a better word, sense of dissatisfactoriness or lack of ease in our own presence in our own being here at this time, this place, and this body, this mind, with these people. You know, whatever it is, there's always, there's often a problem of some kind. And it's, you know, it's ironic that, in a way, I mean, it makes sense, continuous flow, you know what they're talking about, but from another perspective, the characteristic of dukkha or of samsara is exactly the opposite. It's a certain kind of stuckness. So in the early Theravadan or Hinayana quote schools, you know, it's this idea of being, you're stuck in samsara, so you're trying to get off and out of that wheel somewhere. But in Bodhisattva practice, in Mahayana practice, the concern is less to get out of the cycle, but to not get sort of stuck in the ways that we do within it. But anyway, all this is a way of saying that this first line of the gatha that calls us is directly sort of kind of references the first of the noble truth, the truth of dukkha. And, you know, as I tried to indicate, it's nothing, there's nothing abstract about it at all. It's not, I mean, we can talk about it in these very, you know, heady sort of ways, but it's something that, you know, either we're directly experiencing it at any given moment, or, you know, if our eyes are open, we see it amply manifested in the world. So, great is the problem of birth and death. You know what to do. The second line of the gatha, impermanence surrounds us. Impermanence surrounds us seems to me, you know, I get the point, but it seems to me kind of a... kind of a weak way of saying it, because, and a problematic way of saying it, because it makes it sound like here I am, minding my own business, and, you know, everywhere I look, it's impermanence. That's true, everywhere I look, you know, but it sort of sets up this sort of, you know, here I am, and there is impermanence. The problem is much more a problem, if it is a problem, I'm not sure. But the phenomenon, the reality of impermanence is much more, again, it's much more direct. It does not exclude me. It does not exclude you. It's sort of impermanence are us kind of thing. And and in fact, it's precisely at the end of the day, at least in many ways of sort of thinking and sort of dharmic terms, is precisely our unwillingness to sort of come to terms with that and to see that keeps us mired in this dukkha that I was referring to. It's this idea, you know, we have this deep, deep, deep desire, second noble truth, as a cause of suffering, desire to see ourselves as ongoing, persistent, self-existing, whatever terms we use, beings that are somehow outside and exempted from this entire sort of network and circle of causes and conditions. You know, as Reb Anderson talked about here a few years ago, you know, it's like we have this, you know, we like to think about, you know, the circle, and then there's this little sort of bump, you know, that has some kind of special status. Well, no, trying to maintain that special status is what actually propels the churning of that wheel. So, impermanence surrounds us. That kind of alludes to or touches on the second noble truth, that suffering has a cause, dukkha has a cause. The third thing, do not, or be awake at every moment. Be awake at every moment. I'm going to pass that by for a moment. And then maybe I'll refer to my notes and not pass that by exactly. Be awake at every moment. You know, what is that? How do we do that? What is the practice of being awake at every moment? Well, at least there may be other ways to do it, but at least in the framework of Zen practice, it is to engage in zazen, what we've just done here, and to engage in the practice of ethical engagement with the world and other people, in trees and rivers, all those things, the precepts, and the practice of paramitas, the so-called virtues of, you know, generosity, patience, energy, all those things. You know, I don't know that I would really map it onto this Four Noble Truths as I've been doing before, but it's like, well, yeah, you can do it because, you know, it kind of reverses the third and fourth truth, because instead of sort of going now from, okay, reality of dukkha, dukkha has a cause, in the sort of classic formulation of the Four Noble Truths, the next thing would be there can be an end to that process. And then the fourth thing is the statement of the Eightfold Path. In other words, the fourth thing is the statement of, like, well, what do you do? And how do you address this problem? And so in this gata, that comes third rather than fourth. So what do you do? You be awake at every moment, which, as I've said, is the practice of, in our frame, the practice of zazen and precepts and the paramitas. And We talk about those things as if they were different and distinct, and in a sense, they are. You know, what I'm doing here is not exactly what I'm doing in the rest of my life, but you know, it's this thing you see and you hear in sort of Buddhist writings, and, you know, things people say all the time: not one, not two, you know. They're not exactly the same. They're not exactly different either. So I think it's reasonable to think of it as just one thing. It's practice. And, you know, you can say that one could say that zazen, sitting meditation, is what the precepts and the paramitas look like when they're kind of parked on a cushion. And you know, precepts and paramitas are what zazen looks like when it's out walking around in the world. In any case, it's the path. It's the actual exercise of of practice, which is addressed to resolving this very direct, very immediate problem of birth and death. So the last one of the four-part sequence is do not waste your life. This one I will skip for just a moment. It's obvious that what it means not to waste one's life is something for each person individually to work out, to decide for themselves. And it might not look the same for everybody. But there are guidelines, proposed anyway, suggestions that come to us, and we can respond to them if we like. These things, great is the problem of birth and death. Impermanence surrounds us. Be awake at every moment. Do not waste your life. They all come in the form of these kind of assertions of fact, purports to be fact, or commands, be awake. Don't waste your life. It's kind of like, it's got this, it's kind of in your face, right? Part of what happens on our mats and cushions is that sort of assertive, sort of commanding quality, tone, that seems to be thrust upon us, by the world, is actually sort of transformed and softened. So that sort of painful, scary, like birth, death, impermanence, all those things kind of get or have potential to sort of be taken on in such a way that they're no longer external. The awareness of that and the understanding of that, and instead come to be understood as expressions of, transformed into expressions of intention, aspiration, vow, love, all those kinds of things. And that is also marked sort of liturgically in our practice here. We begin with, the han, these sort of loud things, and we end with the bodhisattva vow. And so I don't know if I'm just making this up, but in a way, it's not difficult for me to think about the sort of four lines of the gatha we start with and the four lines of the bodhisattva vow as being a kind of a call and response, a sort of a statement and an answer, or a call and response. It's like, here's the problem, what do you do? And looked at in that way, the pairing would be, great is the problem of birth and death. And then we leave with the bodhisattva vow, the first line of which is, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. There are other responses and other ways to be, to go about it, I'm sure, but something about that pairing seems very, very powerful to me. Thinking about the Sandy Hook things, it's like, I'm sure you're all aware, there's almost nothing else in the news right now, and I was driving up here just now, an hour or so ago, and listening to, various things on the radio, and they were talking to one guy. I wasn't paying attention at first. I think he was a rabbi. He was sort of saying, well, on the one hand, this has been this terrible thing for this community. He was at, in that immediate community. Terrible thing for this community, but it's been sort of very strongly matched by this sort of very powerful coming together of the community. And a sense of our commonality. And then he said something which was really interesting. He said, so now these children and these other people are in heaven, and that's painful for us, but what our task is to bring heaven back here. You know, and the way we do that is sort of person by person, by act of kindness, after act of kindness, you know, and concern, and all those things. Now, for me, the language of heaven seems a little misleading, and sometimes I think it's even dangerous. Nevertheless, I realize, well, it's just not my language. And behind all my own sort of noise about that, I can hear something that's very like the first line of the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. You know, person after person, endless acts of kindness. So, in a very direct way, you know, on NPR tonight, I heard this sort of call and response, you know, this terrible tragedy, and this, that's the right word, and this statement of, well, what do we do? This is it. What else can we do? Impermanence surrounds us, the second one. Sort of matches very well for me with the second line of the Bodhisattva vow. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. The delusions... how do we get from impermanence to delusions? The actual word in the Bodhisattva vow is bonno, which means, Japanese word anyway, which is, you know, obstructions or hindrances, which sounds a little different than impermanence, maybe. But in fact, there's a relation, and the reason is because when we talk about the hindrances in this context, what we're fundamentally talking about is the things like the three poisons, the problems of greed, hate, and delusion. And we ask ourselves, well, where did those come from? And they come from a kind of ignorance. And, you know, the ignorance that allows those to arise is sort of rooted in this fundamental ignorance or a kind of delusion about our own sort of permanence that we have, what they, you know, sometimes translate in these very sort of technical translations, something called own being, a persistent, ongoing, separate soul, identity, ego, spirit, whatever it is. So it's this sort of ignoring of the reality of our own interconnectedness, not only with other people, but with, in fact, all things. And so, you know, the way to address, you know, perceiving impermanence as a problem is to cut through that delusion. And that delusion sort of is very persistent. Probably not going to disappear. But as Dogen says in the Genjo Koan, you know, in different ways, in different places, we can, you know, he says sometimes something like sentient beings are those who are greatly deluded about realization. Buddhas are those who, you know, how does it go? I'm embarrassed. I can't. It's a very simple and elegant way to say it. But the idea is that Buddhas don't sort of wake up from. We don't wake up from delusion. Do you have a chant book handy? But wake up. I just have to satisfy my own mind. Wake up within delusion. Oh well. Ask me later. yeah, here we are. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. Sorry about that. Sidetrack. But the point is that even though we don't, in a sense, leave this world, we don't leave samsara. We have realization, we have delusion at the same time, and we can, depending on how we handle that situation, we can sort of wake up within delusion. Be awake at every moment. The third thing in the gatha matches very well with Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So, you know, as I was sort of saying, the be awake, the practice of being awake at every moment is the practice of zazen, precepts, paramitas, and so on and so forth. One way to think about what those things are is treating everything as a Dharma gate, treating every person, every situation, every desire, every emotion as an opportunity to wake up, as a gate through which you can enter into Dharma and understanding of Dharma, and at the same time, obviously, into an understanding about, you know, ourselves, both as sort of small beings and as part of a bigger picture. And then the final part of the gatha is do not waste your life. This is followed, this sort of matches with the fourth line of the Bodhisattva vow. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. So here, you know, maybe it gets a little sectarian or you know, it's kind of skews a little heavily in a direction that we're already inclined to, but it suggests that a way to not waste your life is to actually become a Buddha. Or to realize that you are a Buddha, and to live in such a way as to make that possible. No one can tell you what it means to waste your particular life, to waste this life, the ones we've got. But we all have a gnawing sense of what that feels like when we're sort of somehow not receiving this gift. You know, and so no one also can tell you how to go about being a Buddha. But I think the sort of clear sort of sequence here of gatha, zazen practice, and everything else, service. And then closing with the Bodhisattva vow, the sort of call and response is sort of a liturgical way to, or liturgically reflects this this call to sort of not waste our experience, not waste our time, not waste our life, and to find out what it might be to live in a dharmic way. This can sound like a pretty big order, and I suppose in a way it is, but in a way it's also just a natural sort of way to be a really human being. And Shakyamuni in one of the Nikaya says something to the effect like, well, you know, I wouldn't ask you to do this if it weren't possible. You know, I'm asking you because you can do it. It's in the human range. We have the capacity. So we began with the problem of birth and death, and had to run through all this stuff. I'm going to close with a bit from Dogen's fascicle, Birth and Death, Shoji. Just the last couple of paragraphs, because it makes it, one of the things I love about this very short fascicle. It's like sometimes Dogen is very, very hard to sort of take in. And, I mean, he's just a challenging writer. But this is, like, very simple and very direct. And it really sort of emphasizes this point I was trying to close with. You know, this is something that we can actually do, not special people, not extraordinarily intelligent or talented people, them too, but all of us. So anyway, I'm just going to close with the last two paragraphs. The whole thing is only about five paragraphs. He says, "Your present birth and death itself is the life of Buddha. If you attempt to reject it with aversion, you thereby lose the life of Buddha. If you abide in it, attaching to birth and death, you also lose the life of Buddha and are left with only its outward appearance. You attain the mind of Buddha only when there is no hating of birth and death and no desiring of nirvana. But do not try to measure it with your mind or explain it with words. When you let go of both your body and mind, forget them both, and throw yourself into the house of Buddha. And when functioning begins from the sight of Buddha, drawing you to accord with it, then, with no need for any expenditure of either physical or mental effort, you are freed from birth and death and become Buddha. Then there can be no obstacle in anyone's mind." And then this is what really kills me. It's so, like I say, it's so direct and possible. "There is an extremely easy way to become Buddha. If you refrain from all evil precepts," all that kind of thing, "and do not cling to birth and death," Zazen, "work in deep compassion for all sentient beings, respecting those over you and showing compassion for those below you, without any detesting or desiring, worrying or lamentation, that is Buddhahood. Do not search beyond this." So that's my talk. Anybody has any comments or questions or anything? Knock yourself out. Done.
So it's like a... For me, it's like pay attention, right? And it's like when the horn gets struck, or even like when that the person that yells.
But it's the same. It's the same thing. It's like.
And I need that because you know I easily get top end or you know not doing not paying attention, not really kind of putting myself. Not paying attention, not putting myself into things, I'm really kind of getting into it. And I do that too, So sometimes then I struggle with the last line, don't waste your life. Because then I'm like, oh, shit, I'm wasting my life, and then I kind of beat myself up a little bit. But it helps me get it too, that's what's, if I don't, so I do appreciate that. And I like the idea because I never think about that either. That when you're hitting the han, that it's kind of going out there every time, and I kind of like that too. That's a cool image. So I like the talk. Thank you so much.
You're welcome very much. Yes.
I'm also really fascinated by what you said about. The idea that don't waste time and that sort of, there's a bit of a slap in the face about it, which could be productive, but also you could kind of go wrong getting attached to that, it seems, and panicking over it. And this idea that somehow there's a softening of that on the cushion is really surprising.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, what does that mean? And, a lot of times, maybe not so much here, but in a lot of Buddhist circles, they're always talking about mindfulness. And we do, we might all lead very different lives, right? I'm sure we all do. But we could probably agree that minimally, one way to waste your life is to not actually turn up for it. And that's what we do sometimes. You know, we're just checked out. You know, we're not, you know, we're busy, but we're not really connected with our own activity, our own thought, our own feeling.
I was struck by the idea of, you talked about special status, and I was reflecting while I was listening to what you were saying, about how special status really is the thing that gets in the way from me being awake. You know, all the stories around special status in very subtle ways, very ordinary ways that draw me away from the moment, thinking that I'm somehow special, or a relationship is somehow special, or a situation is somehow special. But really, it's all about being ordinary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, the being awake is just the constant reminder of ordinariness.
Yeah. And it turns out, you know, just to, if I may, just sort of take that a step further, it turns out what part of what ordinariness turns out to be is, you know, interconnection. We're not really so separate. Did I say anything that pissed anybody off? Everybody's really quiet.
Want to?
No, not at all. But I always just checking. It's like, no, people don't have to agree with me.
Well, I appreciated that you reminded us about the things that we do here, because I think sometimes we sleepwalk through it. Just what you were saying, we're checked out. You know, the thing goes and bells ring. And we're somewhere else. So it's really nice to hear enough detail about the content behind it that helps us all be present during that. Since no one's going to yell at us here, I think we get my attention. I think sometimes we just assume that everybody knows what's going on, and sometimes helpful, thank you.
Yeah.
So it seems like many of these, we come across a lot of Zen sort of phrases that are seem very large and grandiose and impossible.
Yeah.
You could take the first Bodhisattva vow of freeing all beings, but they are numberless, which is an impossibility in itself. So the aspiration then isn't one of, the aspiration isn't so much one of trying to actually enact that where you can free all living beings, but it's just having the knowledge that there are too many beings to be too free, but you can just make sort of like a small indentation in the problem.
I know what you're saying, and it's interesting because all these things. I often think about how, you know, a lot of Buddhist teachings, a lot of Zen teachings, they seem to operate on two levels at once. You know, this very sort of grand scale and this very sort of almost granularly small scale. And there's always a tendency to sort of swing off and get caught up in one side or the other. But with things like the Bodhisattva vow, yeah, it's like, you know, if, you know, as another thing I read by Dogen, he sort of has this line, you know, don't try to, like, work this out, because, yeah, it will appear as an impossibility. But, you know, looking at it in the sort of smaller sense, it's like, okay, you know, here's another person, what do I do? You know, compassion and wisdom, I try to, you know, quote, save them. You know, and another person, what do? I find that again, and you know, meet each person with that try to meet them that way. Or with delusion, you know, oops, here's a delusion, what do I do? Well, I'm going to try to end it. I'm trying to, you know, well, here's another delusion, you know, and it may go on forever and ever and ever, who knows? But we're sort of directed in how to respond, you know. Here's a Dharma gate, also known as practically any experience you can have. What do I do? I use it as an opportunity to awaken. You know, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. And, you know, maybe, I mean, there's sort of a, maybe a thing of like, well, don't try to, you know, you don't have to take care of everything all at once. Just sort of take care of what comes before you, sort of moment after moment after moment, and really commit to that. Sort of one way to think about it.
Yeah. This seems like a big contradiction, which I actually enjoy.
like a logical contradiction? What kind of contradiction?
Yeah, delusions are inexhaustible.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you say that, well then, you can't... what's the next line?
About them.
So you can't end something that's inexhaustible. So it's a contradiction, I feel, like. You know, but it's a powerful one.
But you could also, you can read it as, maybe you'll never come to the end of it, but, if you just sort of take them as they, you know, you retain the commitment to taking care of what you can take care of when you can take care of it. There's something else later, you know. Jeremy.
There's a story of Holly and I think of it's Angulimala.
Angulimala, yeah.
Sirupunch. He was already to kill his 100th victim, which was the Buddha. And there's a story of him chasing the Buddha. I think the Buddha's like a forest path. And Angulimala was chasing the Buddha, and he was like running as hard as he could, you know, with his knife, and the Buddha was just like walking. But he couldn't catch up to the Buddha. And Angulimala finally just stopped, like, why can't I catch up to you? And the Buddha says, because I've stopped. I feel like that's kind of like a nice way of saying delusions are inexhaustible. I'd love to end them.
Yeah, that's an interesting connection. Angulimala was a mass murderer who had the habit of, he would kill somebody and he would cut off a finger and he was making himself a little necklace and was going for his 100th one and had this encounter with Buddha. And he became, one version of the story I've heard is the Buddha turned and just said, please stop or just stop.
Oh.
And, I mean, there are doubtless variants. And he actually became an arhat, a saint. And so, again, it's just sort of like... you know, if Angulimala can do it, we could probably, you know, make some headway ourselves, however mired in our dark, twisted karma we may be.